Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Kuf Bet Amud Bet by the Gemara. We left off with the Mishnah, that depending on the way that the person expresses the sale of the land that's there, will determine what is subsumed in that transaction. The main issue was areas that are not necessarily fertile, were not usually usable as a Beit Zri'ah, as plantable area, vis-a-vis the property that was sold. Question is, how big did they have to be? How deep? How high do they have to be in order to include them, exclude them from this sale? Gemara now brings an alternate Mishnah from the Gemara in Arachin that seems to speak about the same matter, and then we're going to come and compare that or contrast that with our Mishnah. It's not autumn. We have a Mishnah in Arachin. A makdish sadeo b'shat hayovel. Someone who was makdish's field at the time of the yovel. The Rashbam over here changes the girsa to read b'shat hayovel rather than b'shnat hayovel. In the time of the Yovel, rather in the year of the Yovel. So Rashbam points out that this din is only relevant when the Yovel is functioning. Without the Yovel, this din does not apply. When there's no Yovel, no matter what property you are Magdish, the only way to redeem it is at its fair value. When the Yovel is cycling and is in existence, then there's a difference between a Stei Achuza and a Stei Miknet. A Stei Achuza is property that is inherited. Stei Miknet is property that you're basically leasing from the other party that's going to return in the Yovel. That property that you're leasing, if you're Makdish it, then you have to pay its fair value to Hekdesh in order to redeem it. The fair value obviously will be the amount of time that you have a leasehold in it until the Yovel. On the other hand, by a Stei Achuza, the Torah gives a fixed amount of money that you pay per a fixed area. There's a standard price, irrespective of the true underlying value of the property. That the pasuk says in Parshat Bechukotai, v'misteh achuzato yagdish ish l'Hashem. A person takes a property that is a property of inheritance and is magdishit. V'yayar kecha l'fi zar'o. The value will be based on the production. Zera chomer se'orim b'chamishim shekel kosef. So as already the Rashbam noted in the Mishnah, that a chomer and a core are synonymous, and therefore zera chomer seorim means that you have a kor of property or a beit kor of property b'chamishim shekel kesef. Then you pay 50 shekel kesef. As Chazal note, that's 50 shekel kesef for all the years from the beginning of the yovel till the end of the yovel, which is 49 years. If you take 50 and divide it by 49, that means that you're going to pay a shekel of kodesh per year plus a pundion. 48 pundionim make up a shekel. So then you'll have one extra pundion, because it'll be 49 years, not 48. That the Gemara discusses about what you do with that, or what the value of that is, or why it's there, mostly to help defray the costs of having to divide up the money, or break the money down into smaller component parts. And that means that each year, to the yovel that you're makdish the field, then you pay a shekel pundion, shekel kodesh, or a sela and pundion in the Lashona Mishnah, you're going to pay per year. So the situation over here is in a case where the person is makdishit bishata yovel, the time that the yovel is in existence, the way that the Rashbam says it, we're talking about right after the yovel. I mean, he was makdishit for the full extent of the yovel, for that full 49 years until the next yovel. And therefore, he owes 50 shekel kesef. He's going to have to pay the 50 shekel kesef for it. The other girsa that was bishnata yovel, the reason the Rashbam rejects it is because that turns out to be a machloket Rav and Shmuel. Someone's makdisha field during the yovel, what is the din with regards to that? The Baal Tosafot, on the other hand, just simply say bishnata yovel doesn't mean in the yovel year itself. But shnata yovel, mashmir shapir shana shachar yovel, means the first year of the yovel. Not the 50th year, literally, but shnata yovel means that first year of the yovel. And therefore, they were willing to leave the girsa intact that had it read, bishnat hayovel. Notain though, the beit zera chomer se'orim, chamishim shekel kesef, as we just read in the pasuk in Parshat Bechukotai, that for every beit kor that he has there, he's going to pay out 50 shekel kesef. If you're makdish the field and you want to get it back, the only way to get it back from Hekdesh is to give them the equivalent value so that you take it or you redeem the field and take away the kedusha. Here, there's a fixed payment amount based on the area of the field, irrespective of its underlying value. Pay 50 shekel kesef for every beit kor, you'll get the property back. If you do not do that, when the Yovel comes around, you will lose the property entirely. It'll become the possession of the Kohanim. Kohanim will get it at the Yovel. Whenever Mishmar falls out at the Yovel, they will be the possessors of this property going forward. By Stei Mikneh, obviously you don't own it enough for you to give it to Ekdesh and be permanent because you only have a leasehold on it. At that point of the Yovel, it'll go back to the original owner. But if you want the field, you need to redeem the field. And this is the price for redeeming it. So similar to our Mishnah, it presents obstacles to this being considered a total field. And that is that there are these cracks, crevices that are more than 10 tfachim deep. Or there are these inclines or raised areas that are more than 10 tfachim above the level of the ground. Ein nimdadim imam. They are not measured along with it. They are not included with it. Now, over here, what does it mean? Ein nimdadim imam. So the Rashbam says, v'leka lememar ein nimdadim imam. The lo kachei klal. Can't say what it means is that, oh, they're not counted with the field, that they're not kodesh at all. That would be strange to say that here he's makdish the field. There are these areas of the field that are high and low, which make it so that they're not able to be used along with the field. Oh, so then you're not makdish them. No, you're makdish them, they're just not going to have the same status as the field itself. And the Baal HaTosafot say the same thing over here. It says, lefi cheshbona kaduva pasha. V'leka lemeimer inan dimima delo kachei klal. He says that it just means that they're not subject to the rules of the Pasuk, which is that there's a fixed payment rate per area or Beit Kur that's there. They'll be subject to the other rules of Ekdesh, which is you got to redeem them at their fair value, whatever the value of that property is. So it'll break down the field into two pieces, which is the parts of the field that are plowable, usable, that will be subject to the rule of Beit Zerach Chomer Se'orim, which means 50 shekel per Beit Kur. Those places that are higher and lower will be subject to the rule of redeeming them at the fair value of the price. That's the way that the Rashbam, the Baal HaTosafot, learn over here. There is an alternate opinion, which is really related to the way that they explained the Mishnah yesterday, which is, Einim Dadimima would mean that you don't pay for it at all. You don't have to redeem it. It is not Hekdesh. So we said yesterday in the Mishnah, the Yad Ramah, the Rambam, the Rimigash, I'll explain the Mishnah of Ein Nimdadim Ima means that you have to give him a Beit Kur Afar. And Ein Nimdadim Ima means that this becomes a bonus. The person gets it free of charge because he can't use it based on the descriptor that was given for the sale. So you have to give him that full amount. And these extra spaces will just be yours as a bonus. If you say that in the Mishnah, then similarly over here you can say Ein Nimdadim Ima means you don't pay for it. If these things in a sale would be a bonus and you wouldn't pay for them, then in Hekdesh it would be the same thing. When you're Makdish them, then it's as if they just come in as a throw-in with the property, they wouldn't be Kodesh, and therefore you would not need to redeem them. So there is a group of Rishonim, similar to what they said on the Mishnah, Ein Nimdadim Ima means literally you get none of it, you don't get paid for it, you don't get anything, it just is a bonus along with the sale. So to over here, with regards to Hekdesh, it'll be a bonus, quote-unquote. If you redeem the rest of the field around it, then these will come along with it, and you don't have to pay for them separately. Pachot mikan, if they are less than that, nimdadim imam, then they are included in the field, meaning that you would redeem them along the same lines as you're redeeming the rest of the field that is there. So far, this is similar to our Mishnah, that there's a difference between that which is above 10 tefachim and that which is below 10 tefachim, above 10 tefachim. And again, the same thing with the depression. I mean, it's below 10 tefachim, and it's more than 10 tefachim into the ground. Those are not included with the field. Things that don't reach the threshold of 10 tefachim, they are lower than 10 tefachim, or not deeper than 10 tefachim, they are included along with the field. Ve'amai, why is that the case? L'kadshu ba'anpei nafshayu. Why don't they just take on a hekdesh of their own? In instance, what the Rashbam says is, split it up into two fields. These areas that are more than 10 tefachim, why are they not included in this cheshbon? What the Rashbam says is, v'yachol lifdot kol echad v'echad b'fnei atzmo, k'makdish shtei sadot. It would be no different if you were makdish two different fields, you redeem each field independently. V'yachol lifdot zeh shelo b'zeh, v'kadsho. Miu b'anpei nafshayu, k'shir tzeh yifdeh utam v'nikayim b'fnei atzman. So to over here, these depressions, these higher places, or these strips of stone that are rock or bedrock that are in the field, then you should be able to redeem them independently. Why does the Mishnah indicate Ein Nimda Dimima. They're not accounted along with it. So the way that the Rashbam learned Ein Nimda Dimima means they're not included in the regular pricing for a Steachuza. You can't do it at 50 shekel per Beit Kor, but rather you have to do it at its true value. So the question of the Gemara according to him is then, why is that? Why don't you just count them as two separate fields and you redeem each of them as a Steachuza? You have one big area and then you have one small area that you redeem as a Steachuza. Why are we changing the din vis-a-vis these areas that you're claiming Ein Nimda Dimima? Or according to the Yad Ramah, the Rimigash, the Rambam, why are you saying that they go as a bonus and you don't pay them at all? Just look at them as two different fields, and each field you redeem independently. So then you say, V'chite, Imakim and Delavi Beit Kor, Lo Kache. So what are you going to say to me? Since they don't meet the minimum threshold of a Beit Kor, they're not Kodesh. V'atanyo, we have a braita that says, Sadeh, Matam Alomar. When the Pasuk says, here that we just read, V'misteh Achuzato. So there the word Misteh, does that mean Matam Alomar? The Fisha Nemar, Zerach Omerim Sarim, B'shamishim Shekel Kesef. I would have thought you need to meet that minimum threshold of a Beit Kor or a Beit Chomer Se'orim. It's the equivalent of a Beit Kor in order to redeem it at that rate. V'nayin d'rabot, letech. Letech, v'chatzit letech is half a Kor, 15 Sa'ah. Chatzit letech would be half a quarter of a Kor. Sa'ah, a Sa'ah, tarkav is 3 Kav. V'chatzit tarkav is 1.5 Kav. So in 6 Kav in a Sa'ah. So all of these, Tamilomar, Sadeh, Mikol, Makom. The Pasuk says that it doesn't matter what the size of the field is, as long as it is a Sadeh, because it says, Misteach Uzato, then that Sadeh is redeemed at the value relationship that is mentioned in the Pasuk. So it's going to be Pareta based on the size of the field. There'll be a relationship. You know what the relationship is. It's 50 shekel per Beit Kor. You take half a Beit Kor, you're going to buy 25 shekel Kodesh. So it's very easy. You just figure out the relationship to a Beit Kor, and then you use that same relationship to multiply it by the 50 shekel Kesef. But once you've said that, there is no minimum threshold. So then again, the question of the Gemara is, why are you separating between the field and the Nikayim and Slaim? They should have the same rule. Even if you want to say that they're considered or classified as two fields, because they're too deep or too high, they should still be under the same auspices as the field itself, which is you should redeem them at a steachuza. Your question is, why does the Rashbam focus as considering or classifying them as shtei sadot? Why doesn't he just say it's one big field? It doesn't matter what the usage is or whether they can be used together or not. You should just have to buy them out at that prorata space. So the Rashbam does it intentionally, and the Baalei Tosafot pick up on it and think he's wrong for what he did. If you look at the Baalei Tosafot, V'mayla Kadesh V'afdei Nafshayu, Perisha Rashbam, K'makdish Shtei Sadot, Shechol Iftot Zeh B'lo Zeh, gives you the right to redeem them independently. V'ein Nir Adari, Dim Kein, Afilu B'stei Achad, Yechol Iftot Chetzio, Lufi Cheshbon Beit Zerach Omer Se'orim. There is no limitation in terms of redeeming a field. You can redeem sections of a field at a time. So the Rashbam, what he was trying to avoid was, by making it to Shtei Sadot, he was given the ability to redeem each one independently, and that you didn't have to do it all in one shot. The Reish says that's not necessary. You have a right by a steachuza to redeem it in sections or in parcels, and therefore you could simulate the same effect even with a singular field. And therefore he says that the Gemara's question is just simply, why don't they get the same valuation, which is not using the real value of it, but rather this fixed pricing? So even though they have independent significance and they're not counted along with it, they should still become Kodesh. And since they should become Kodesh, they should be redeemed at the same value as that field. So according to the Baalei Tosafot, you're right. You could make it into one big field. It doesn't really matter because you can take it out in sections. The Rashbam was trying to avoid this problem of whether you can redeem a field in sections or in pieces. And so therefore he says, oh, it's shtei sadot. Since it's two sadot, then you can redeem each piece at this fixed rate. But either way, the question of the Gemara is, why doesn't Hekdesh impact the Nikaim and Slaim the same way it impacts the field? And it should be classified as a Steachuza. Even if you want to identify it as an independent piece of property, still it should garner the same requirements as the remainder of the field, which is it's redeemed at 50 shekel kesef per Beit Kor. So Gemara says, Amar Rav Ukva bar Chama, Hocha b'Nikaim, Mleim Mayim Maskinan. Here we're talking about depressions, ditches, sections of the ground that are filled with water, which makes it that they are no longer plantable or fertile space. Dekanami, that you could be medayek from the situation, the circumstance, diktani, dumya dislaim. The two things that are mentioned in the Mishnah are slaim gvoim, bedrock that is high, and nikaim, and depressions or ditches. So it's clear that slaim are unplantable area. You can't plant on bedrock. It doesn't support the ability to plant on it. So similarly, the nikaim are areas that don't support planting in them. Shmamina. So therefore, that makes sense that it's not included in the field, because there is a requirement that when you have a steach huzah, that it's based on zri'ah. It's based on the ability to plant it. And since it's not plantable, it's no longer called a beit zera, komer selrim. Beit zera implies that it is fertile and able to be planted. If it's unable to be planted, then it's not incorporated in this din. So the reason it's excluded over here by Agdesh is because there are two things. Number one is, it's too deep, or it's too high to be included in the field. And in addition to that, it doesn't get independent assessment, or it doesn't become Hekdesh independently, at least not for its fair value, but at the Beit Zera Chomer Sorim for a Chamishim Shekel Kesef, because it's not plantable. It has water in it, and it's not able to be used as a Beit Zera. And that's why it's not included under that valuation. Where it says, Ihochi, if that's the case, Afilu Pachot Mika Nami. So then why do you need it to be 10 deep or over 10 high in order for it to be excluded? Even at lesser rates, it should be the case. Hanu nagane da'ara mikru, shidre da'ara mikru. That is because when they are not above 10 tefachim, or not deeper than 10 tefachim, they become a part of the contours of the land. In the case of the selah, the bedrock, they call it the spine of the land. So it's included there because it's like bedrock that runs strips along the land. That's a natural part of the land. That's what you expect when you have pieces of land. And so therefore they become a part and parcel of that property. They're not viewed separately or independently because they're not significant enough. And they have a certain natural topography to them, which you would expect in a property. And they're called the spines of the land and the nagane, depressions of the land. Ve'en lam shem bifnei atzman. But they're not considered to be significant in and of themselves. So you see here, the way that they're described is not that they have a name called a crevice or a cella. They're called Nag'ane De'ara, or they're called Shidre De'ara, which means that relative to the land, they're given their name. They're the spine of the land. That means that they're still included, or they are subsumed under the descriptor of the whole property. The same thing with these depressions. It's a depression in the land. So since they are incorporated in the land itself, they have the same din as the land itself. They are included together or a part and parcel of the land. Because, as the Rashbam says, is a cute way of saying it, you can't have land be planed off with a plane or sanded down with a file, so they don't have any depressions or any little mounds. Land, by definition, the topography is not absolutely level or flat. It has contours up and down. And given that, you expect that these types of things will happen or be there, and they are incorporated into the land. They're considered a part and parcel of the land. So that's the difference there in the Mishnah Arachin. The first thing is, you need two things to disqualify it from being a parcel of part of the land. That is, it has to be deeper than 10 tefachim, higher than 10 tefachim, and then it has to be unplantable space. So by slayim, that's easy. By bedrock, it's clearly an unplantable space. By bikim, you need water in there to make an unplantable space. Therefore, it's not included in the din of beit serach homer selrim for 50 shekel kesef, because it's not beit zera. It's not a place that's plantable. Then it'll go, depending on what you thought earlier, it'll either mean that it's not kodesh at all, or it'll mean, according to the Rashbam and the Balei Tosafot, that you will assess it at its fair value rate, and you'll have to redeem it at that, not under the rubric of a stei achuzah. If it is less than 10 tefachim high or less than 10 tefachim deep, then it becomes a part of the contour of the land and it's subsumed under the land. So now, this is very similar to our mission over here, with one exception, which is this requirement for there to be water in there in order to disqualify them from being included with the land. Our Mishnah never mentions water, and that's the question that the Gemara asks over here. Hacha mai. What is the din over here in our Mishnah? Do you require there to be water for it to be considered not part of the Beit Kor Afar, or even without water? So Amar Rav Papa, afal pi she'ein leim mayim, Rav Papa says, even without water, they're not included over here. Mai taima, ein adam rotzeh, she'itein ma'utah v'makom echad. Person doesn't want to pay for a parcel of land, v'iru lo kishnai mushlusha mikomot, and it'll truly be two or three fields. Person's buying a parcel of land, he's buying a section of land, he wants to buy one unit of land. He doesn't want to buy land that is subdivided into different pieces because of these depressions, ditches, or these mounds that are on there that are so high that it prevents him from working the field as one big field. Just abstractly, the key difference between them is that by the case of Ekdesh, we have a specific requirement of Beit Zera. It has to be plantable space. As long as it's plantable space, then it's included under the din of the Torah of Beit Zera, Chomer Seorim, for 50 Shekel Kesef. So as long as it is a Beit Zera, it doesn't matter if it's two fields, three fields, four fields. We don't really care about that. We care about whether it is fertile and plantable. So as long as it qualifies, it'll be under that ruling and you'll redeem it in that way. The only way to not be included in that is to be separated from the field and also not plantable. For that, you need both more than 10 tefachim high, deeper than 10 tefachim, plus water in there or something that prevents you from utilizing. By the case of our Mishnah, which is a sail, there, it has to do with Lashon B'nai Adam. It has to do with the way that people communicate or articulate these types of items. People don't buy fields that have dividers in them. Even if the dividers are plantable, it makes it impossible for them to work the plow straight across the field. So it's a serious inconvenience to them, and that's not what they meant. When they said, I'm buying a Beit Kor Afar, they meant a single parcel of land that they can work in one shot. Not something that they're going to have to pick up the plow and then work on the other side or take it around to the other side because of this ditch or this hill, even though that's a plantable space. It's a separate location. It's going to be viewed as an independent space. And he didn't buy it to have one field on this side, one field on that side, and then have a field in that piece in the middle. He bought it to have one area that he can work and get the economies of scale of doing it with one field. So that's the difference in the din, and that's why the outcome is different. By the case of Kiddushin, you have to make it unplantable. By the case here in our Mishnah, you just have to make it that it divides the field, or it doesn't make it into one field. So that's why you get a difference in the din between selling, transactional, and Hekdesh. Now, Matkif La Ravina, Va'adumia Dislaim K'tani. The only little problem with this is that in the Mishnah Arachin, we noted there was a diuk that favored the explanation of it being unplantable space when there was a ditch, because it put it in parallel to Slaim. It said you have Slaim or Nikaim. So it says, oh, the Selah is clearly unplantable space. So that must be that the Nikaim are also unplantable space. How do you make them unplantable? You have water in them. Our Mishnah does the same thing. Our Mishnah brings two problems. It brings Nikaim amukim asrat tefachim, o Slaim gvoim yud tefachim. If you're going to run that same parallel in our Mishnah, that would imply that the Nikaim and the Mishnah are also unplantable space. The only way to make them unplantable space is to have water in them or something that prevents you from being able to use them because they are unplantable. So how come you don't make that same deal out of our Mishnah that you made out of the Mishnah in Kiddushin? So he says, Maslaim de labnei zrianinu, afhani nami de labnei zrianinu. That would be the case. He says, Kitani dumi deslaim apachot mikan. The comparison to Slaim is relevant in the latter part of the Mishnah. In the latter part of the Mishnah, it says that if it's less than 10 tefachim high or less than 10 tefachim deep, it's counted with the field. The chiddush over there is that even if the Nikaim are unplantable, they are still included in the field. So that's where you compare the Nikaim to the Slaim. In the latter part of the Mishnah where it says they are included in the field, there you say, well, Selah is included in the field even though it's not plantable, and same with Nikaim. They're going to be included in the field even though they're not plantable. That's where the chiddush is. Since they brought them together in the Seifa, they also brought them together in the Reisha. But then it's Lav Dafka in the Reisha. In the Seifa, it's a comparison that is exact and says, even though it's unplantable space, it's included with the field. In the Reisha, when it brings them together, it's saying, even if they are plantable space, it still is not included because of the height or depth of these items. It's comparing Nikaim to Slaim. We already brought relevance to that in the Seifa. So in the Reisha, we're not going to bring that deal. Now, obviously, that's a harder answer to give to our Mishnah, and therefore in the Mishnah Arachin, where we're going to explain it that way and we can't explain it that way, we're going to say that Nikayim and Slayim are compared and it's unplantable space. We came up with a way to get out of it in our Mishnah because of the Reisha versus the Seifa, but that wouldn't be your first choice of how to explain it. Our first choice of how to explain it would be like we do in the Mishnah Arachin, and therefore that will be the explanation over there. Over here we'll use that to explain the Seifa, but the Reisha will not be Davka, and therefore it could even be a Neka, it could even be a ditch without water in it, and that will be disqualified or not included in the Beit Kura Far that you're supposed to provide over here. Alright. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Treshim Sheamru, Beit Arbat Kabin. Treshim is a term that's used, Rashi brings it on Chumash with regards to Hebron, it's Makom Treshim, means an area that is full of stones and rocks, an area that is unplantable. So what Rabbi Yitzchak says is, Treshim Shamru, when we say that the space in the Mishnah is not plantable space, it's rocky space, we're talking about Beit Arba'at Kabin. We're talking about four kav of space. When it says that, Pachot Mikan Nindadimima, less than 10 tfachim, high or deep, is included with the field, there is a limit to that. That is not unlimited, that has a cap on it, which is you can't have more than four kabin to a Beit Kur. You see here in the Rabbeinu Gershom that the four kav is something that's davar chashuv. Because he says, if you have less than four kav, lo vidavar chashuv ba'an pei nafshayu, ukugufa shel karka damyo, and therefore it's considered like part of the land. But if they take out more than davar kabin, avidavar chashuv, even though they're below the threshold of 10 tefachim, there's just too much or too many of them that it already takes on a certain amount of significance. So there is a relationship between the two, which is that your maximum amount of unplantable space in a Beit Kur is 4 kav. Remember that there are 6 kav in a sa'ah, 30 sa'ah in a Beit Kur. So I'm talking about for kabin, I'm talking about two-thirds of a sa'ah. You take that relationship, and then the way the Rishbam says it, that relationship will be meaningful even in lesser spaces. It's not just that this is the number for a Beit Kur, or arba kabin is always the measurement. It's a relationship of relative nature. So if you say that you have a Beit Kur that has 30 sa'ah, and each sa'ah includes 6 kav, that means that you have 180 kabin in there. And then you have 4 kav over 180, so it's 4 over 180 is your standard measurement of how much you can have of this unplantable area that's supposedly subsumed in the contours of the land. That's the maximum amount you can have. And he says, "Wadin the kabayim b'chatzi kur." You have a letech, which is 15 sa'ar, half a kur of space. You don't have a kabayim. You'd have 2 kav instead of 4 kav would be the relationship. About but above that level, Lokeach is unwilling to accept that amount because he asked for a Beit Kur Afar. There has to be a limit that when you say Beit Kur Afar, you say, oh, look, it's all contours of the land. It's all bedrock, but it's all along the plain of the land. Can't say that. There's a limit of how much you can give that is unplantable or unusable land for him that is included under the contours of the land, and that is Arba Kabin. So that's what the statement of Rabbi Yitzchak says. Amar Rav Ukva Bar Chama, Rav Ukva Bar Chama now qualifies that statement and says, "V'hu shemuvayim b'chameshit kabin," and that is only if they are included in 5 kav, which means that the distribution of it is across 5 kav. If they are spread out even more, according to this, it would be even better. But the 4 kav are acceptable when they are distributed amongst 5 kav. It's not an area or a space where all 4 kav are consolidated in one big block of space. Rather, it's spread out over the field. The more that it's spread out over the field, the more chance you would include it in the field itself, or that it'd be batel to the field. So the requirement of how spread out it has to be, according to Rav Ukva Bar Chama, is v'hush mu'vim b'chameshit kabin. It means it has to be 4 kav that it's spread along at least a minimum of 5 kav, that it takes up an area of 5 kav. Then Rabbi Chir ba'Abba and Rabbi Yochanan v'hushu muvayim beruba shel sedeh. So there are two ways to read this. Is Rabbi Yochanan qualifying Marukva, or is he arguing Marukva? The way that the Rishbam reads it and others read it is that he's arguing. And he's saying, no, it has to be distributed evenly amongst the field. That when you have 4 kav, you can't have it concentrated anywhere. It has to be spread over the robe of the field. It has to be spread over the majority of the field. In order for it to be considered or classified as being a part and parcel of the field, but sell to the field, you need a distribution of it so that it becomes a little obstacle here and a little obstacle there. The more concentrated the problem is, the more problematic it is, because it prevents you from working the field as a single entity, or it breaks up the field, causes you problems with the plow. If you have a little obstacle, you can work the plow around it, you can move around it. But that's the understanding that Rabbi Yochanan has. So if you do the math, then you have a Beit Kur. A Beit Kur is 30 sa'ah. A majority of that, the row of that sa'ah, will be 16 sa'ah. So what it's saying is that you need 4 kav over 16 sa'ah. Or in essence, you need a quarter kav per sa'ah. That's the type of distribution you would need in order for it to be subsumed under the sale or included in the Beit Kur Afar, to be counted towards the Beit Kur Afar. And you won't have to replace that land. It'll be a part and parcel of the land. So that's the way to read it according to this, which is that it's qualifying our Mishnah, first of all, that Rabbi Yitzchak is coming to tell us in our Mishnah there's a cap as to how much space can be considered unplantable or unusable space. Again, it'll be the same thing for the Mishnah in Arachin according to this. For Mishnah Arachin, the qualification is unplantable space. For our Mishnah, it's just simply something that divides the field up. What's the maximum amount of this that you have in your field that is tolerable when it is less than 10 tefachim high or less than 10 tefachim deep? That is 4 kav. What is the distribution of that? We have Marokfo who says it has to be distributed at least over 5 kav, which means that it's very dense still, but it's just not all in one unit. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan requires that you have it spread over 16 sa'ah, over a much larger area, or a quarter kav per sa'ah, and that's the relationship that is tolerable. For every sa'ah, you get a quarter kav of this problematic land that you can tolerate up to a maximum of 4 kav for a Beit Kur. Just so you know that there is an alternate view that Rabbi Yochanan is really qualifying the statement of Rav Ukva. And rather than saying that he's arguing and say that he's qualifying for you where the 5 kav have to be. It's not telling you that, no, it had the 4 kav have to be distributed over 5 kav. And Rabbi Yochanan is saying, no, the 4 kav have to be distributed over the robe of the sadeh. He's rather telling you, what is the 5 kav? Where are the 5 kav found, or where are the 5 kav distributed? And so that's what he's saying here, that they have to be berubah shel sadeh. It's defining where the 5 kav have to be, not where the 4 kav have to be. What Rabbi Yochanan is saying is that the 5 kav, that where you have to measure that within the 4 kav, there 4 kav of selah, there is 5 kav of space, that 5 kav has to be distributed over ruba of the field. Can't be that it's so concentrated or that 5 kav is concentrated. So this again goes to the idea that the less concentration, the more likely we're to see them as a separate entity. So yeah, you say it has to be 4 kav out of 5 kav, but that distribution has to be over ruba shel sadeh. That has to be across the robe of the sadeh. So ba'i Rabbi Chiya ba'ava, ruban bimi'uta, umiutan biruba mahu. The truth is that the question is the same, which is that if you have the rove in the miuta sadeh, majority of the 4 kav are found on the lesser part of the sadeh, meaning the 14 sa'ah of the side of the sadeh, umiutan biruba, and the remainder is found on the 16 sa'ah side of the field. It's really complementary. Obviously, if most of it is found on the miut of the field, then the remainder of it will be found on the larger part of the field. So now we said in Rabbi Yochanan's statement that you have to have 4 kav distributed over 16 sa'ah, or in essence, a quarter kav per sa'ah. The question now becomes, well, if you have it distributed over the whole sadeh, but the majority of that 4 kav is found in the smaller part of the field, in the 14 sa'ah part of the field, does that then disqualify it? Because we now say that you have reached the maximum amount over the entire field and it's too concentrated? Or do we say that the piece that's on the other part of the field is ke'eno, it's as if it doesn't exist, and then you haven't reached the 4 kav limit, and therefore it's okay? That's the way to explain it. You can see that in the Rabbeinu Gershon, which is, mi amrin en hol viruban shel trashim b'miuta shel sadeh keman de'itnuhu kulan dami. It's as if the whole 4 is in that section. Since the robe is in that section, it's as if the whole 4 in that section. Vein in the dim, and therefore they're considered to be separate. the Dover Chashuv Bifnat small, because it takes on significance by itself. Because the whole four kav is not found in that part of the field. It's not significant enough. It's as if it's been spread out or it's distributed amongst the field. So the question basically is what governs over here? Is it the relative concentration or is the fact that it reaches the threshold of four kav? So if you require that it reaches the threshold of four kav, then in the area which is a mute of the field where you have less than four kav, it doesn't take on significance as it hasn't reached the four kav level. If you say it has to do with the distribution concentration, over here the distribution concentration is much higher, because even though you have less than four kav, it's in an area that's less than rove of the field, and therefore it's too high a concentration. Together with the other pieces in the rest of the field, you have the four kav, and you also have too high a concentration, and therefore it doesn't count. So that's the question being posed in that position of Rabbi Yochanan, and the answer is teikul, we don't know. We don't know where the emphasis is. Is the emphasis on reaching four kav? Or is the emphasis on the concentration level? How much is found in a small area? And therefore, you could disqualify the field because you have too high a concentration in a small area. Or maybe the field only disqualified when you have the full four kav in that smaller area. So that's the question. The Gemara leaves it as a teiku. By Rabbi Yirmiyah, Rabbi Yirmiyah over here says, Kishir mahu. If the four kav are distributed like a shir, which is a tabat, you can see the picture in the Reshbam, it is a ring. It's distributed as a ring in the field. What is the din? The way that the Reshbam reads the Gemara over here is, the next, each one of them is imtim salomar. If you conclude about this first one, we're going to ask another question right after this. So that means that it's going from the most likely to be included in the field to the least likely going to be included in the field. So this is the one that most likely would be subsumed in the field. The way that the Rashbam views it is that, you can see in his picture, you have a formation in a circular formation that has pieces of land in between it. So the cell is distributed as a ring, but the ring has areas of land that you can get between the rings around it. So it forms the shape of a ring, but there are breaks in the ring that allow you to access that area. So that's the nature of the question. Question is this area accessible now with the plow? Therefore, it should be included in the land because there are these gaps to get into the middle of the circle or through the circle. Or do we say that the person wants to plow his land once lengthwise, once widthwise, and he can only do that if he has clear way to move the tractor or the plow along? Over here with this big circle in the middle, even though there's pieces that allow you accessibility, it's still not where you can run a straight line across. You can't run a furrow straight across the field. And that's an impediment that would invalidate the sale over here. He frames it this way. You can't plow through it longwise and widthwise. When he reaches the bedrock, you have to lift up the plow ma'at for a very short distance. Until you cross over the bedrock. And then you continue. But it's made like a ring that you can't plant it so easily. Then what is the din? Then the Gemara says, Kishura mahu. If it is a row, what is the din? And here the Gemara, the way the Rashbam reads is imtim salomar, that when it comes to this circle, it is included in the field. Then kishura. If it is a row, then what is the din over there? So you have, the way that the Rashbam describes it, a row is not a row like you would have thought, but it's a row like this, which is broken up. It has spaces of plantable and unplantable space, but they're done in a sections like that, like the picture along the way that he has here in the Rashbam. So now here it's much more difficult to plow, because the obstacles are continuous. There's one obstacle, then you put the plow down, another obstacle, put it down. There's too many obstacles there. Even though there's empty space in between, you'd have to lift the plow too many times to get through it, and therefore it's too difficult to be included, versus the circle where, okay, it's an obstacle, but it was a manageable obstacle. Others explain it that by a shura, even though you can plow one way, the length of the field, you're going to be impeded on doing it the width of the field, because people plow along both directions. So the shura only affects you in one direction, not the other. So that's the question here. Is that enough of an impediment that it's considered to be a separate entity? Fimtim Salomar, the way the Rashbam reads it, if you say Kishura Nididimimah, that it would be included in the field, it's Tadidinan Mahu. If it is like the stadium oxen, Mao, what would be the situation? You can see the picture in the Rashi. It's like the horns of the stadium oxen that it goes out, not just in a straight line, but it breaks to two sides. It's two lines that break out like the horns and spread out. So again, that makes it more difficult to plow because they're running along the field and there are two of them. It's much more difficult to plow given that setup. And then Imtim Salomar, that is considered to be okay. Akalaton, if it is a zigzag, if it is not a straight line, what's the din there? Whether it's included or not included, that's Mao, and the Gemara leaves it all as a teku, an unresolved issue. So that's the way the Rashbam explains it. The Rashbam explains that in all these cases, you have bedrock and plantable land. The question is, how much of an impediment is the bedrock versus the plantable land that's in between? And as you move along, it becomes harder and harder to move the plow through here because the obstacle is becoming more significant and the difficulty of plowing it becomes much more burdensome because of the obstacle or the sela that's there. You can see that according to Rashbam, the last case with the zigzag, it's so hard to plow the field both lengthwise and widthwise because it's interfering in both directions with your ability to plow. In the case of the shura, that's really only interfering in one direction, not the other direction. But the atzadah was the least form of impediment because of the spacing in between them that gives you the opportunity, both widthwise and lengthwise, to get around the impediment. That's the way that the Rashbam explains it. The series of questions over here relate to how concentrated versus spread out amongst the field they are. Talking about trashim. You speak about Rabbi Yitzchak's trashim, they were distributed all over the field. Now you have a concentration of those trashim that create a certain structure, and they're not as random as what we were speaking about Rabbi Yitzchak. They have a more of a concentrated structure. How does that impact on what we were saying? On the other hand, the Yad Ramah over here says that the question relates to whether these are considered to be a single unit or a separate unit. It's not a case like with the Rashbam where he says that there's Sadeh in between them. It's just that they are shaped or closer together or in a way or manner that makes it more difficult to work with them. But rather, the question relates to, are they considered to be one entity? The trashim are separate stones that are all over the field. Here, where they're concentrated in a certain design without other pieces of field in between them, are considered to be one unit, and ain nimda nimima, or are they considered to be separate stones and therefore nimda dimima? And that also influenced the explanation before of what four kav and five kav means. According to Rashbam, it just means what's the distribution concentration level. If you have four kav spread amongst five kav, that's enough to be determined that they are not significant. On the other hand, for these Rishonim, who think that the question is whether it's considered to be one unit or not, if they are more concentrated, like four kav within five kav, then the four kav is all considered to be one big sela, and that's why it's a problem. The more that you spread it out, the more that you distribute it over the field, the less likely it is considered a sela yechidi, and therefore it's more likely to be included in the sale of the field and not be considered a separate entity. The Gemara says, teku, unresolved. So generally, when you have an unresolved issue in monetary matters, teku is a motzi mechavero alav araya. All right, Tano, imaya sela yechidi, if it is a single block of rock, afilu koshu inidad ima. Even if it's a small amount, it is not counted along with it. Right? So the way that the Rashbam views this is, Amatznitin Kaima Breita. This Breita is qualifying our Mishnah. Diktani Pachot Mikani Damdimima. That less than 10 Tfachim is included in the field. And what he's saying over here is that if all this area, this Sela Yechidi, is one big block of rock, then it's not included in the field. It's hard to understand what that means. Why is that different? If it's less than 10 tefachim, it should be fine. So what the Rashbam claims is that this is similar to the next line in the Breita, which is, b'imayu samuch le'meitzar, if it was right on the border, afilu koshu enim darima. Even if it's the smallest amount, it's not included in it. So we're going to use that first, and then I'll come back to the original case. In that latter case, if you have a problematic land on the border, the buyer says, not included in the field. Because included in the field means that you're subsumed in the field. What we're saying here is you have a Beit Kura Afar, and then you have these small sections that aren't plantable. We say that's acceptable, or there's a normal threshold by which people are willing to accept. But that's because it's in the middle of the field. So in the middle of the field, it doesn't negate the fact that this is a Beit Kor Afar. It doesn't negate the fact that this is a field. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if it's on the edge of the field, the guy can say, it's not subsumed in my field. It's on the border. Just start the border after that piece. Or, in essence, it's not subsumed because the field doesn't surround it on all sides. So that's the second point that the Braita is making. And then the Rashbam says that's similar about the first case in the Braita, which is that the case here is that the bedrock starts outside the field. So you have a sela yechidi. You have a singular block of bedrock that comes into the field. There's a small portion of it. Afilu koshu enters into the field, but nevertheless, it's attached to a much bigger piece of bedrock that starts outside the field. So again, here you have a similar condition, which is you can't start counting the field from the middle of that bedrock and say, oh, here's your Beit Kor Afar, delineate it, and this piece of bedrock that is a part of a whole piece that was outside the field now enters a little bit into the field. You say, oh, that's in the field. Because it's part and parcel of a sela yechidi, a block of stone that's coming from outside the field, you have to say that the field starts after that point. You can't start the field in the middle of that bedrock, even though that bedrock is less than 10 tefachim off the ground. Or in essence, for the Rashbam, it is the same question, just phrased differently. In one case, you have a piece of bedrock, a large piece of bedrock that's entering into the field from the outside, and the border runs across that bedrock. What it's saying is that bedrock can't be counted towards the Beit Kor Afar because it's attachment to the bigger piece. And then the second question is, even without that, even a independent piece that's there is still problematic because it's on the border. Being on the border means that you're not subsumed in the field. It means that you are an entity that has significance in itself because you're not surrounded by the field on all sides. And so that's both statements of the Braita are coming to qualify our Mishnah and say there are certain cases that even when it's below 10 tefachim high or less deep than 10 tefachim, they still will not be included because of their positioning on the field. That's the way the Rashbam explains it. You can see the Balei HaTosafot on the other hand say, what does Sela Yechidi mean over here? Perish Rabbeinu Tam, Sela Yechidi, Ainu Sheish La Shem Levai. It has its own, call it nickname or accompanying name. It's called Sela Ploni. So it's called Yechiel's Rock. Since it has a significant name to it, and identified independently, it's not subsumed under the field. It's not batel to the field, because it carries a shame bifnei atzmo, and that makes it chashuv. So that's what Rabbi Notam says. We're talking about two cases here. That even if it's in the middle of the field, a sela yechidi is not counted, because it has its own name. It has a significant name to it, which gives it independence. Then you have the second case in the Braita, which is something on the border. On the border, you don't need a significant name or an independent name. Just because it's on the border, it has a problem because it's not surrounded by the field on all sides. The Balei Tosafot explain Sela Yechidi differently. They agree with the Rashbam that it's modifying or qualifying our Mishnah. But qualifying our Mishnah with two things. One is if it has an independent name, it gains significance and you can't subsume it in the field no matter where it is in the field. Secondly, if you have Sela on the border, then it can't be included in the field because you just start the border after that Sela. The Rashbam views both cases of being talking about the border, one a case where it's an extension from bedrock into the field, and the other case where it is a small rock or a piece of stone along the border, and you would have to read it as lo zu af zu, according to the Rashbam. Not only this case is it problematic where it's attached to a larger bedrock, but even the case where it's independent, if it's on the border, it won't be included. That you can see in the Rashbam, the way he explains it, kach nira be'inai v'ikar. That's the right way to explain this. But you know when the Rashbam says that there was an alternate explanation that he is rejecting. The alternate explanation, which is accepted by other Rishonim, is v'rabateinu, my rebbeim mifarshim, the Rabbi Yitzchak koi, that this braita is qualifying the statement of Rabbi Yitzchak. Before Rabbi Yitzchak said, bitrashim, when you're talking about the rock or the stuff that's in the field, the maximum amount you can have is beit arbat kabin, four kav. On that, qualifying that statement, and the Braita is saying, "V'hashkatzi Braita le'meimar, di'avuhanu arbat kavim sela echad." If that four kav is a single block in the field, afilu koshu ein nimdadim. Even if it's a koshu, it's not included in the field. Klomar, afagav de'ein gvoin gimel lo betile. Even though they're not above three tefachim, it is still not batel. The way that the other Rishonim are describing it is that there's going to be a difference between above and below 3 tefachim. The only thing we note in our Mishnah is that above 10 tefachim and below 10 tefachim is considered to be different. Above 10 tefachim, it gains its own significance. Below 10 tefachim is part of the field. The Rashbam notes is that in many other places in Shas, Gimel tefachim is a significant amount. Gimel tefachim is part and parcel of the land. Above Gimel tefachim is considered to be separate. So what he's saying is that there are actually two thresholds over here. There's a threshold of 3 tefachim. It's a threshold of 10 tefachim. 10 tefachim, it makes it chashuv b'fnei atzmo, but not chashuv. 3 tefachim is something that where it's considered the land itself, or is it batel to the land? If it's under 3 tefachim, it's considered part of the land, period. Above 3 tefachim, we say it's batel to the land, because it's not significant enough. So what he says is the koshu over here means it's under 3 tefachim. Despite it being under 3 tefachim, if the 4 kav are aggregated in a single space, they're one big block, it's not batel, it's not part of the land, and it's disqualified. I mean, you can't have that in the land. He says here, Benodo Nihirali Hai Perusha Klau. He says, I don't understand this explanation at all. So first of all, he says, what does it make a difference if it's one block of stone, or whether it's stone that is spread out across the whole field? Meaning that, according to the Rishbam, it actually works out to be better for you if it's one block. If it's one block, then you have one space in the field you can't work, and that's it. If it's spread out over the field, you have all these obstacles all over the field, it's much more difficult. Obviously, the other Rishonim view it just the opposite, which is then you have it in one big block, you have a section of the field that can't be used. When it's spread out all over the field, you can just simply maneuver around the obstacles. If they're small obstacles, you can maneuver around them. Or you can remove them from the field piece by piece. It's one big block of selah. It's going to be very hard to get that out of the field. If there's smaller pieces around the field, it'll be easier to get them out of the field. So the other Rishonim see that as an advantage versus a disadvantage. But the Rishbam clearly doesn't see that. But then his bigger problem is, Vod, minayin lanu sheish chiluk b'chol pachot miyud ben gvoa shlosha l'pachot mishlosha klal v'klal. Where did you ever hear there was such a distinction between above 3 and below 3? Our Mishnah, the Mishnah Arachin, only mentioned 10 as a threshold. They never mentioned that additional threshold of Gimel Tefachim. Where did you come up with this idea that below 3 Tefachim should have a different status than above 3 Tefachim? And therefore he rejects this understanding. But his rejection is obviously the position of his Rabbeinu, his Rebbeim, as well as some other of the Rishonim, which is that this is modifying or qualifying Rabbi Yitzchak and not our Mishnah. And saying that when you have the distribution of 4 Kav, if it's aggregated into one space, then it doesn't count. And again, if it's all along the border, no matter how low it is to the ground, it won't be counted when it's on the border. So that's the way that the alternate reading of this. Though there are others like the Rimi Gash that explain the Kol Shu, who are not referring to the height, but to the width of the item. Even if it is narrow and very small, as long as it's a Sela Yechidi, then it's not nibdadinimah, it's not included in it. And that which Rabbi Yitzchak said before about Trashim is that these are stones that are distributed or rocks that are distributed all over the field. Not talking about a singular bedrock or stone that goes across the field. And the obvious difference is whether they're removable or not. And again, that's the key difference between what the Rashbam is saying about them being concentrated versus being distributed. Where we said that these Rishonim clearly believe that it's the opposite. Baira Papa. Mufsak afar bentayim mahu. If there is a little strip of afar on the other side of the bedrock on the border, is that enough to make it that it's subsumed in the sadeh? How much do you need on the other side of the rock to make it in the middle of the field versus on the border of the field? If you have less than 3 tefachim worth of afar that is on the other side of this bedrock or this selah, toward the border, is that enough to make it subsumed in the field? Or is that still considered to be part of the border because you can't put a plow on the other side of it? It's not wide enough to put a plow there. Gemara says, Ma'o teiku, they leave that as unresolved. By Ravashi, Ravashi comes and asks. Again, the Rashbam says, Zim Tim Salomar. If you want to say that the Hefsek Afar is enough, that 3 Tefachim of Afar on the other side would be enough to separate it from the border, then what's the question is, Afar Milamata, Betunamala milamala, or far milamala, betunama milamata, mahu. When you have this setup where you have this either bedrock with earth on top of it, or you have earth with bedrock on top of it, what would be the din there? So the assumption being that now that piece is workable. If you have bedrock with dirt on top of it, so even though it might not be deep enough to plow, it's still deep enough that you could plant things over there. And therefore, does that qualify as part of the sedeh to be mevatel the sela with the remainder of the field, or is it still considered to be on the border? Or the other way around, when you have the bedrock on top of the afar, which means that if you pulled the bedrock out, you'd actually have plantable space below there. So in that case, is that considered to be enough of a land to create a separation between the border and the remaining bedrock? So if you have the bedrock that is above the ground, and then right before the border it dips down, and it has earth on top of it. It's still below the surface there, the bedrock, and so it's not so deep, but there is earth over there. Does that consider now that the other side has field on it, and now it's subsumed in the field, or not? Or the other way around? You have bedrock, which is very deep, but towards the edges, you have pieces that are much thinner, that if you pulled them out, you'd be able to have a workable field over there. Also, is that enough of a strip on the other side to define it as being subsumed in the field? And again, the Gemara leaves it as, Ma'o, what's the din? Teiku, unresolved issue over here. Next Mishnah. Beit kor afar ani mocher lecha. So that's similar to the first Mishnah, which is I'm selling you a beit kor afar. So whatever the qualifications were that we spoke about in the first Mishnah apply here. But here's the additional language that he's adding. Mida bechevel, measured by the string. The string is the official measuring tool that is used to measure land and to know what the size is. And he says, I'm selling you a beit kor afar measured by the string. Pichet koshu, if it is less than a beit kor afar by any amount, yinache, then he has to reduce it. Hotir koshu, if he put in extra, yakzir, it has to be returned. So over here you have a statement that says, I'm giving you exactly a beit kor. If he says that, in essence, he has to provide exactly a beit kor. If it is less than that, he has to reduce the price. Now, obviously, he can't give him more land because he doesn't necessarily have more land to give him. So then he has to reduce the price. On the other hand, if they gave him more than it, the person has to return that excess amount back to him because he said exactly, and that means the transaction surrounds an exact measurement. The Rashbam asked a basic question because the solution here in the Mishnah is that you have to refund the amount or you have to add on additional payment in these cases to rectify the situation. The question is, why is that the solution to the problem? Because we have what's called ona'a. Ona'a means when you overcharge or undercharge for something, you don't just rectify the differential, the mekach is batel. It undermines the underlying transaction. You're going to say, that's okay because below the threshold of ona'a. Over here it says kosho, or the threshold here is below ona'a. And therefore, you won't have a problem because it's below the threshold of ona'a, and that's why you just refund the differential, or you pay the extra amount, and you don't undermine the transaction. The Rashbam says that's a problem because we have the statement of rova. If you remember, we had earlier in this masechta, we had it in Bava Metzi as well. Kol davar should be mida, should be mishkal, or should be minyan. Anything that comes as an exact measured amount, whether it's a quantity, whether it is an area, or it's a weight, then even less than 1/6 differential is considered to be ona'a. By definition, since it's sold in a very fixed manner, in a measured way, any deviation from that measurement is considered to be ona'a. So why over here don't we have a consideration of ona'a? He said he's going to sell him a beit kor afar, and then that's not what he got. He didn't get a beit kor afar, and he used a measured amount. That should mean that there is ona'a over here. So the Rashbam says that the answer is that's the difference between metaltalin and karka. Metaltalin have a din of mida, mishkal, and minyan, because metaltalin are units, and therefore when you talk about units, you're talking about in quantity and weight. Property, lo shayach mu chazara, tekim lo rabbonan, denechle lo lokeach liknob mashim tza, lefi mida, hein chaser, vein yeter. Chachamim believe that when it comes to property, the buyer will take whatever he can get his hands on. So in their day, again, property was the ultimate value, ultimate stored value, as well as the way to ensure wealth for your family. Buying property was a big deal, and if you got your hands on property, the Chazal assumed, even if it was not exactly what you were looking for beit kor afar, still you would buy it, and then you just refund the differential. It would not be considered mekach batel, because it's not under the rubric of ona'a based on what we know about karka. So the Rashbam basically says that it's a difference in the nature of metaltalin versus karka. By metaltalin, people want to buy. They buy based on what they said. A number, a dozen eggs. They want to buy a dozen bagels. They mean a dozen. They don't mean 11, they mean a dozen. And so when you deviate from that, there is onah. And then when they buy a piece of property, they want to get that piece of property, but if it's off by a little bit, you'll just change the price, but they'll accept the property because they want the property. So that's the view of the Rishbam. And it might have to do with the fact that unit or metalkalim can't really be subdivided and have the same shame, whereas karka is always karka. So when you subdivide it, it's still called karka, it's still valuable to you. That's the way the Rishbam answers the question of why there is no ona'a over here, despite the exact nature of the measurement that's associated here, which should deem it to be ona'a. Most of the Rishonim disagree with this Rishbam, because we find Rova broad in context of karka. And even in context of karka, the Gemara says that mida mishkal minyan, something that's exact measurement, has ona'a, even by karkaot. And so that would undermine the Rishbam's explanation here as to why there is no ona'a in our case. You can see that on the Tosfot on the top of the next Amud, where he points out that the Rishbam's assumption is incorrect, because even by karka, Rova applies. Vomari, the Rova Irik is a madadu v'yitahu b'mida. The only time that the mida becomes an issue for ona'a is if they measured it. They went out and actually measured it, and then he lied or he tricked them with regards to the measurement. When he sold it to him, they never measured it. They only measured it after the fact. He knows that it's not exact from the beginning because he hasn't measured it yet. That's why it's acceptable over here. So that's why the Balei Tosafot say Rova's din is not applicable here, because you didn't represent that it had been measured. You represented that it would be a Beit Kor Afar, and now we're going to go measure it to make sure that that's what it is. So you want to know, by definition, it's not going to be exact because he never measured it before. So if it measures within range of normal deviation, that's fine, and it's not subject to the din of ona'a of Rova. Whereas for many other Rishonim, the solution to the problem is the buyer's view of the property now that it's missing something or that it has less than he expected. Is it still the item that he intended to purchase, and therefore the Mekach is kayam, and you just have to adjust the price? Or is this really not what he wanted? So obviously, if there's a huge deviation away from the core, then you're not going to just adjust the price. You're going to say the Mekach is batel, just because there's such a great differential between what he had offered him and what he gave him, then clearly that's not what he intended for, and the Mekach is batel. If it gets closer and closer to the amount of Beit Kor, then you have to ask the question, is the buyer getting what he expected? Yes, it's a little different in size, but generically or generally, it is what he wanted. And that could be both from an objective or a subjective standard. You can say it on an objective basis, he wanted an area that could be planted and used, and he got an area that could be planted and used. It slightly deviates from what he wanted, so we'll adjust the price, but we're not going to say the Mekach is batel. Or we can say from a subjective side, did he get what he wanted? Yes, he might have wanted more, but did he get what he wanted? And therefore, that's determinant over here, and that's why the din of Rova is not applicable. By metaltaline, when a person wants exactly the weight or the amount, he intends for exactly that weight or the amount. He doesn't intend to get any more or get less, because he wants to utilize it for that. By karka, which has the same utility overall, and it can be used even with small deviations, it won't change really the dynamic of the situation. Over there, maybe Rova's din doesn't apply, and that's on the aggregate what many of the other Rishonim are saying. Imamar, if instead he says, hein chaser, hein yeter, whether it's more or less, or in essence he's saying, Beit Kor Afar, more or less, the modern expression of pachot o yoter, which is more or less. So I'm not giving you an exact measurement. So there will be deviations over here. Afilu pichet Rova l'sa'a. Even if there is, on a measured basis, a rova kav to a sa'a, then it's good. O hotia rova l'sa'a, higiyo. Then it goes. The transaction goes through. So meaning that there can be deviations. We allow for a deviation of a quarter kav per sa'a. If you remember that there are six kav in a sa'a, so a quarter kav, I mean 1/24. The deviation could be up to 1/24 of the measurement. Either way, whether it's an excess or it's too little, higiyo, the transaction is done. And the reason that the Rishbam says that the Mishnah expresses it as a rova kav per sa'ah and not 7.5 kav for a kor, which would be the equivalent amount, that'd be 1/24 of the kor, is because he wants to show you that no matter how small the sale is, that relationship or ratio still exists. So he gave you a smaller quantity to show you that this relationship exists no matter what. Yoter mikan, if it is more than that, yaseh cheshbon. Then you have to do a calculation and figure out what to do. Then you have to either reduce the price, or you'd have to raise the price to deal with it. But the differential, that is beyond the amount that you suggested. All right, so now yaseh cheshbon. So now you have to calculate the differential and deal with it. So the Rashbam over here qualifies that statement in a number of ways. The first is, kagon shlo huzlu karkaot. It's a case where the price of the property didn't change. Because if the price of the land changed, then it's not fair to say to the guy, you gotta buy more, or you gotta buy less, so I'm gonna refund you because there's a price change over here. He says that the situation is, kikaime. It's a case where the price is steady, and therefore now you have to figure out what the differential is or how to deal with their differential. And that, the Mishnah now says is, ma'machzir lo, ma'ot. He has to give him back money. Vimratza, machzir lo karka. And if he wants, he gives him back property. So in the case where there's excess land here, there was too much land given in the transaction, and now the buyer has to return the excess land to the seller. What the Mishnah says is, yaseh cheshbon, you do a calculation. The mocher, the seller has a right to say, pay me cash, or is a right to say, return the land. He gets to choose how you deal with solving the problem. Why does the seller have the right to make the decision over here? In order to give him more power in this case. The reason being is that it's a takanat chachamim for the protection of the mocher. Because here he just sold him a huge tract of land, and it was a little in excess of a rova kav lisa'a, and now he has a small parcel of land that exceeded the amount. So now when he goes to return it, he's going to give him back this tiny parcel of land that is completely useless. He can't do anything with it. It's not worth it. The guy who owns the whole tract of land now, that little piece of property is valuable to him. But the guy who sold it to him, it's not valuable. Therefore, the seller has a right to demand that he just pay him for the excess, which means, in essence, he's making him to pay for more than he intended to buy. He had intended to buy a sa'ah. Now he has more than a rova kav over that sa'ah that he gave to him. He's going to make him pay for the excess amount of property. So even though we're forcing the buyer to pay more, the reason we do it is basically because of midat sdom. For the buyer, it's a valuable acquisition because it's just now an appendix to that which he has there. For the seller to get back that little parcel of land is completely useless and it's going to have no value to him. So therefore the Chachamim gave him the right to say, give me cash and just pay for the excess. Or he has the right to say, I want the land back. He gets to choose. Now the opposite way around, which is of course, if it's less land than that is there, that was supposed to be there, then the buyer just pays less. Obviously if the seller has no more land to give him, you can't demand that he give him land. If he has more land, then maybe we would demand that he give him the right area. But without that, the buyer gets his money refunded because there's nothing to discuss. Shim shi'er b'sadeh beit tisha kabin. He left in the field an area that is 9 kaf. Ubin gina, and in a garden, beit chatzi kaf, a half kaf. Uchadivrei Rabbi Akiva beit rova kaf. Of Rabbi Akiva, a quarter kaf. Magzilo et akarka. Then he has to return him, he returns him the property. He no longer gets that benefit of asking for the cash. Doesn't he just return the rova kav? He returns everything that is the excess. So this latter part has two sections to it. The first section is that when it comes to mocher, we said the seller has the right to determine as to whether he wants paid more cash or he wants the land back when he gave excess to the buyer. If it exceeds the threshold and he gave too much to him, here the buyer will have to pay more to pay for the excess property or give the property back. That was the choice of the mocher. What the Mishnah says is that's only the choice of the mocher if the land doesn't take on significance in and of itself. If the land that has to be returned over here already is so significant that it's considered to be an independent entity, then the buyer can say to the mocher, you can't claim now, it's too small a property, I have to give you cash. I can hand you back the excess property and you have a block of land that is considered to be a sadeh. You have a block of land that is considered to be a gina. That we already saw earlier in the Masechta, that the minimum shiur for a sadeh, when you say you're going to sell a sadeh, is 9 kaf. So over here, the threshold for selling the property and saying that it's subsumed under more or less was 7.5 kav for a kor. Up to 7.5 kav, you have to do nothing. That's captured under more or less. Above 7.5 kav, until 9 kav, There, the seller will have a choice. Either tell the buyer to pay him more money or get the land back. Once it exceeds 9 kav, then it's the buyer's choice. And the buyer says, take your land back because you have a significant enough piece here in this excess of 9 kav. Since it's significant in itself, you have to take, I can force you to take the land back because you can't make the claim. What am I going to do with this property? You're going to make it into a sadeh because it is a sadeh. The same is true by gina. The threshold for gina in the Mishnah earlier in the Masechta was half a kav is considered to be a gina. Rabbi Akiva argued over there and says that a quarter kav is considered to be a gina. And same thing over here. The threshold for returning property would be a half kav or a quarter kav by a gina. And then the Mishnah makes the last statement, which is that when you have too much over here, the excess has to be returned. It's independent of how he compensates for it. I mean, he can compensate either by paying more or returning the land. This is independent of that. The question now is, when we have Mechila, Mechila says that up to a certain amount, people are mochel. So in this latter part of the Mishnah, when it says that people are mochel on a certain number of properties, a rovakav per sa'ah, when you exceed that amount, how do we view it? Do we say when you exceed that amount, then you just have to return the excess and the remainder is Mechila? Or do we say once you've exceeded that amount, then you have to return the whole excess? Because you now have already discovered that it's way over the amount that you wanted. But then, is a person still mochel on the base amount, but he just wants the excess back? Once he finds that it's way over that level, he wants the whole amount back to get you back to the exact measurement that was there. The Mishnah says that you don't just return the motar, you don't just return the excess, you return the excess plus the amount that would have been acceptable. So in a case, let's say it's 8.5 kav and a core. In that case, you wouldn't just return the 1 kav to get it down to 7.5. You'd have to return the full 8.5 kav because the mechila no longer exists. And that's what the Mishnah is saying over here. That is the shita of the Rashbam, who says that as soon as you cross over that threshold of 7.5 kav per kor, then you've exceeded the mechila amount, and then you have to return not only the excess, but the whole amount. On the other hand, the Rimi Gash believes that this statement is modifying that which just came before it in the Mishnah. And then it's only true in a case when you cross over Tisha Kabin. So that should be 3 different levels. There'll be Mechila, which is up to 7.5 kav per kor. There'll be an issue where you'll have to return the excess amount. That is between 7.5 and 9 kav per kor. You just have to return the excess to get it back down to 7.5. And then once you cross over 9 kav, you'd have to return everything, including the first 7.5 and the additional 1.5 that got you up to 9. Whereas for the Rashbam, the way it is that as soon as you exceed 7.5, you have to return everything if you're going to return it. All right, now the Gemara says, Ibailu, Beit Kor Stama Mai. What's the story when you just say Beit Kor? You don't say Bida Bechevel. You don't give the exact measurement. And you also don't say Hein Chaser, Hein Yeter. You don't say more or less. You just say Beit Kor Stama. Which way does that fall? Is the Beit Kor Stam meaning that it's exact measurement? It goes like Mida Bechevel? Or when you say Beit Kor Stam, does it mean more or less? Which of the two languages does it go? Gemara says, Tashma, you can learn from our Mishnah. Beit Kor Farani Mochelecha Mida Bechevel, Bichet Koshu Yinache, Yeter Koshu Yachzir, Ha Stama, Tehein Cheser Vehein Yeter Dami. So what it sounds over there is that when he says to him, I'm selling you a Beit Kor Afar, Mida Bechevel, and he gives you the exact amount, then that's when you're held accountable for the exact amount. If he didn't add in the language of Mida Bechevel, then he would not be held to that standard, which means that it's equivalent of saying, when you say Beit Kor Afar, it's equivalent of saying more or less. Because unless you specify that it's Mida Bechevel, we'll assume it means more or less. But it says, wait a minute. Eima Seifa, you can be Medayek just the opposite from the latter part of the Mishnah. Vema marlo hein cheser hein yeter. He says more or less, afilu pichet rova l'sa'ah, or yutir rova l'sa'ah higiyo. Then there's a certain amount of deviation which is acceptable. Hastamo, if he didn't say more or less, he just said beit kor, kamida bechevel dami. Then it would be equivalent of saying that it's an exact measurement. Ela meha lekel amash memina. From a Mishnah, you cannot figure out what the beit kor is because the Mishnah goes both ways. The Mishnah gives you the case where you say exact measurement, and it gives you a case where you say more or less. The Mishnah doesn't tell you the case where you don't add on any modifier, you just say Beit Kor. That cannot be addressed by the Mishnah. And the Rashbam says, in addition, which the Gemara does not address, the subsequent Mishnah, our next Mishnah says, Mida bechevel amor lecher lecha hein cheser vehein yeter. In the Mishnah Kamiyapi, he gives both languages. He says that it's mida bechevel, hein cheser hein yeter. He says exactly, more or less. So what's the din there? That's the din in the next Mishnah. From there, he says, you can't determine anything. Because as the Rashbam notes over there, the reason that the language of hein cheser hein yeter governs is because tfos lo shon acharon. The last thing you say is binding. So when you say exactly and then you say more or less, we say the more or less is binding. Not because in a case where you just said beit kor, more or less would be binding. It's because over there, the later language governs. You could have thought that you could prove from that Mishnah. The Mishnah says, if you say both languages, then it's as if you said more or less. Well, that could be the same as saying nothing. If you say both languages, they offset each other, and it's as if they're not there. So from that, you should have been able to extrapolate and say beit kor afar without anything there means, hein chaserin yet, they're more or less. He says, no. That Mishnah is different because over there, you can say the lashon acharon governs. And that's why that's the din. Not because they offset each other as if there's nothing there. It's because the later language is what governs. It says you can't prove anything from that Mishnah. Therefore, we need to move on to another proof to try to figure this out. Tashma. Beit kur afar ani mocher lecha. Kip beit kur afar ani mocher lecha. Hein chaser hein yeter ani mocher lecha. If you use any one of these three languages, so I'm selling you a beit kur afar. I'm selling you like a beit kur afar. I'm selling you a beit kur afar, more or less. Afilu picheit rovadasa, otir rovadasa, higio. Then, even if you deviate up to a quarter kav per sa'ah, it goes. Alma, from that you would conclude, stama nami kein heser kein yeter dami. That when you just generically say it, it's the equivalent of saying more or less. Because it brought three languages in that statement of the Braita. It says, if you say beit kur afar, without any qualifier, ke beit kur afar with the kaf demyon, or you say hein chaser hein yeter, more or less, they all have the same din as more or less. So that's pretty explicit that beit kur afar without any qualifier is the same as saying more or less. But it says, no. Hatam prushe kamifarish. It's explaining you what the statement is. Ezo beit kur, shehike beit kur. What beit kur has the din like a beit kur? The way to read the Braita is not, these are three different cases, but it's one case. You have a beit kur afar that is like a beit kur afar. When do we say a beit kur afar is like a beit kur afar? That's when you use, say, more or less. You say more or less, then you can do it with the kaf demyon. It's as if you put in a kaf demyon, and then you have this fluctuation or flexibility there. Matkiv lo Ravashi. Ravashi says, im kein, ani mocher lecha lomali. If you're right that the Braita is all one case, and it's coming to explain to you what's the situation in which a Beit Kur Afar will suffice to be like a Beit Kur Afar, that's when you say hein chaser hein yeter. Why does each case in the Braita say Beit Kur Afar ani mocher lecha? Ki Beit Kur Afar ani mocher lecha. Hein chaser hein yeter ani mocher lecha. You only need to say the word mocher lecha once, because all one case. The fact that it says it's three different times over there, Elav Shma Minah, from there you would conclude, Stama Nami Kein Cheser Ein Yeter Dami, Shma Minah. From there you would conclude that it's pretty clear that when you make this statement without any qualifier, it means more or less. So that means the default scenario when you say Beit Kur Afar is to mean more or less. The way to change that is to articulate you want to meet the Bechevel, to say it's exact. But if you don't say it's exact, the assumption of every person that's buying something is that you're generally around that level. It's not exact, but you're around that level. We're going to stop here by the two dots in the middle of Kuf Dalet Amud Aleph.